cards was in Europe for use with public telephones. It solved a nasty problem in spare change for travelers from other countries, and it simplified the maintenance of public phones. But the real coup was that it gave each country's PTT, public telephone and telegraph, a cash float similar to what checking account deposits give to banks. Because the PTT is a closed system, it could be rolled out unilaterally and imposed on consumers, albeit for their benefit. From telephony, smart cards have evolved into other niches. They are used for video decoders and satellite-distributed subscription TV. They are also used for parking fees, toll collection systems, military base IDs, healthcare cards carrying patient information. Get the pattern? In every case, it is a closed community, allowing a central agency to unilaterally impose the structure. This ensures high saturation rapidly, thereby justifying the economics of the new infrastructure. Now, the United States is the least closed community on the planet. And so it should come as no surprise that its adoption of smart cards lags the rest of the world dramatically. And yet it is the United States, perhaps, that will champion the killer app that will drive smart cards to a whole new level of deployment. The Internet, with its demands for a universal security system. But that would represent ubiquity at its least dense, something that is anathema when you are trying to cross the chasm. So here is the dilemma. How do you get to universal deployment most rapidly? Chasm crossing theory says, act locally, then globally. Begin, that is, with high-security internet-based applications inside closed communities, corporations, financial trading, civil and military intelligence, healthcare information sharing, and the like. Eschew any reader that is not integrated into a PC. The rest of the world will lead in those applications. One attractive form factor is a card reader embedded in a PCMCA card, able to leverage the broad deployment of PCMCA slots. Work the intranet to extranet to internet pattern that is emerging with so many worldwide web-based applications. That is, begin with an internal set of employees, then incorporate trusted partners, then elite customers, and then move out to broader audiences. Do not go straight to mass deployment. If you try, you will not pass go, and you will not collect $200. Applications versus platforms. As the previous examples have illustrated, there are different risk-reward trade-offs in chasm-crossing strategies, depending on whether you are marketing an application or a platform that can host other applications. For the actual chasm-crossing applications have a huge advantage. That is, because disruptive innovations are more likely to be championed by end users than by the technology professionals that operate the current infrastructure. Applications are what an end user sees. They can readily gauge the benefits of them. And if the application fixes a broken, mission-critical business process, they can insist on its deployment, in spite of an IT department's reluctance. Platforms, by contrast, are multi-purpose by definition. They are infrastructure, and as such, are the domain of the IT community. Charged with maintaining the security, reliability, and performance of the current infrastructure, this group is not quick to adopt disruptive technologies, which require widespread re-engineering of systems. To accelerate the adoption of platforms, then, vendors must clothe them in applications clothing. That is, they must tie them directly to an application in order to gain the end-user sponsorship necessary to secure a beachhead. Often, this involves seemingly unnatural acts particularly in the mind of the engineering team, who continues to point out that a computer cannot tell if the transaction is a real estate sale, a newspaper publication, or a revised will. But the communities sponsoring the technology can. Word-of-mouth corroboration of buying decisions is the key criterion in the pragmatists' adoption process. And since real estate people do not talk to newspaper people, and neither of them cares much to talk to lawyers, you cannot develop word-of-mouth support across them. You must pick one, saturate it, and then move on to the next. Applications normally lend themselves nicely to this kind of niche-by-niche market extension. Moreover, in any niche that you have saturated, you are likely to remain the market leader for a long time to come. Pragmatists do not like to switch. But this arpeggio progression has a downside. It is much slower than mass market adoption. And so if a mass market does emerge, while you are working your handful of niches, some other player is gaining the rest of the world. This is what happened to Wang with its word processor application once PC-based word processors emerged. It is what happened to Lotus Notes when the internet emerged. It was what happened to the Macintosh when Windows emerged. It was what happened to Silicon Graphics in the face of Sun and Intel. When markets go mass, platforms have the advantage. Because they can participate openly in many value chains at the same time, they can be taken up in multiple segments simultaneously. And when they become identified as simply a requirement for doing business, as the fax machine, voicemail, laser printers, and local area networks all were in the 1980s, and as cell phones, laptops, email, and the internet all have been in the 1990s, then they deploy like lightning. These are the huge wins in high tech. Just understand, they are also the hardest types of technology to get across the chasm. From idea to implementation. It is now time to move from the basic idea of chasm crossing to its actual implementation. In the next four chapters, we will break up that challenge into four pieces. First, we will look at how to select the point of attack, the place to cross, the beachhead, the head bowling pin. Then we will look at what kind of offer it will take to secure that initial target market, and how we, as a fledgling enterprise with limited resources, can go about fielding such an offer. Then we will look at the enemy, the forces that seek to throw us back off the beach and back into the chasm, and how we can position ourselves for success. And finally, we will look at the selling systems themselves, pricing and distribution, to help us pick the right approach to the market during this particularly vulnerable time. The critical attitude to maintain in all four of these challenges is that chasm crossing represents a unique time in your enterprise's history. It is a far cry both from your past, where selling to visionaries was the key to success, and your future, which will be focused on either niche or mass market expansion programs. Between these two stages is a singular moment of transition, the penetration of the mainstream market, an act of burglary, of breaking and entering that requires special techniques used at no other time in the technology adoption life cycle. 4. Target the point of attack. I don't know who said it. It sounds like the sort of thing that gets attributed to Yogi Berra or to his mentor, Casey Stengel. But in any event, when it comes to crossing the chasm, this saying absolutely holds true. If you don't know where you are going, you probably aren't going to get there. The fundamental principle for crossing the chasm is to target a specific niche market as your point of attack and focus all your resources on achieving the dominant leadership position in that segment. In one sense, this is a straightforward market entry problem, to which the correct approach is well known. First, you divide up the universe of possible customers into market segments. Then you evaluate each segment for its attractiveness. After the targets get narrowed down to a very small number, the finalists, then you develop estimates of such factors as the market niche's size, their accessibility to distribution, and the degree to which they are well defended by competitors. Then you pick one and go after it. What's so hard? The empirical answer here is, I don't know, but nobody seems to do it very well. That is, it is extremely rare that people come to the Chasm Group with a market segmentation strategy already in hand. And when they do have one, it is usually not one they are very confident about. Now, these are smart people, and a lot of them have been to business school, and they know all about market segmentation. So it is not for lack of intellect or knowledge that their market segmentation strategies suffer. Rather, they suffer from a built-in hesitancy and lack of confidence related to the paralyzing effects of having to make a high-risk, low-data decision. A high-risk, low-data decision. Think about it. We already know that crossing the chasm is a high-risk endeavor, the effort of an unknown and unproven invasion force marching into the camp of some fierce and established competitor. We are either going to get it right, or we are going to lose a substantial portion, perhaps even all, of the equity value in our venture. In sum, there's a lot riding on this kind of decision, and severe punishment for making it badly. Now, with that in mind, think about having to make what may be the most important marketing decision in the history of your enterprise with little or no useful hard information. For since we are trying to pick a target market segment that we have not yet penetrated to any great extent, by definition, we also lack experience in that arena. Moreover, since we are introducing a discontinuous innovation into that market, no one has any direct experience with which to predict what will happen. The market we will enter, by definition, will not have experienced our type of product before. And the people who have experienced our product before, the visionaries, are so different in psychographic profile from our new target customers, the pragmatists, that we must be very careful about extrapolating our results to date. We are, in other words, in a high-risk, low-data state. If you now turn to the established case studies in market segmentation, like as not, you will discover they will be based on work done on market share problems in existing markets. In other words, work done in situations where there is already a reasonable amount of data to work with. There are precious few paradigms for how to proceed when you cannot examine market share data, indeed cannot even conduct an informed interview with an existing customer of the type you are now seeking to win over. In short, you are on your own. Now, the biggest mistake one can make in this state is to turn to numeric information as a source of refuge or reassurance. We all know about lies, damned lies, and statistics. But for numeric marketing data, we need to open up a whole new class of prevarication. This stuff is like sausage. Your appetite for it lessens considerably once you know how it is made. In particular, the kind of market size forecasts that come out of even the most highly respected firms, the ones that get quoted in the press as showing the bright and promising future for some new technology or product, are by necessity rooted in multiple assumptions. Each of these assumptions has enormous impact on the resulting projection. Each represents an experienced, but nonetheless arbitrary judgment of a particular market analyst. And all are typically well documented in the report, but also typically ignored by anyone who quotes from it. And once a number gets quoted in the press, then God help us, because it has become real. You know it is real, because pretty soon you see new numbers cropping up, with claims for their legitimacy based on their being derivations of these other established numbers. As you can see, this whole thing is a house of cards. In some contexts, it even has some uses, particularly where financial managers must deal on a macro level with high-tech markets. But it is absolute folly to use such numbers for developing crossing-the-chasm marketing strategies. That would be like using a map of the world to find your way from the Newark Airport to the World Trade Center. And yet, that is what some people try to do. As soon as the numbers get up in a chart, or better yet, a graph, as soon as they thus become blessed with some specious authenticity, they become the drivers in high-risk, low-data situations, because these people are so anxious to have data. That's when you hear them saying things like, "It will be a billion-dollar market in 1995, if we only get 5% of that market." When you hear that sort of stuff, exit gracefully, holding on to your wallet. Now, most of the people who come to the Chasm Group are more sophisticated than this. They know the numbers do not provide the answers they need. But that doesn't mean they feel any better about having to make a high-risk, low-data decision, which means, in effect, they are stymied. It is our job to get them out of this semi-paralyzed state and back into action. The only proper response to this situation is to acknowledge the lack of data as a condition of the process. To be sure, you can fight back against this ignorance by gathering highly focused data yourself. But you cannot expect to transform a low data situation into a high data situation quickly. And given that you must act quickly, you need to approach the decision from a different vantage point. You need to understand that informed intuition, rather than analytical reason, is the most trustworthy decision-making tool to use. Informed intuition. Despite our culture's anxiety about relying on nonverbal processes, there are situations in which it is simply more effective to substitute right-brained tactics for left-brained ones. Ask any great athlete or artist or charismatic leader. Ask any great decision maker. All of them describe a similar process in which analytical and rational means are used extensively both in preparation for and in review of a central moment of performance. But in the moment itself, the actual decisions are made intuitively. The question is, how can we use this testimony to our advantage in crossing the chasm in a reasonable and predictable way? The key is to understand how intuition, specifically informed intuition, actually works. Unlike numerical analysis, it does not rely on processing a statistically significant sample of data in order to achieve a given level of confidence. Rather, it involves conclusions based on isolating a few high-quality images, really data fragments, that it takes to be archetypes of a broader and more complex reality. These images simply stand out from the swarm of mental material that rattles around in our heads. They are the ones that are memorable. So the first rule of working with an image is, if you can't remember it, don't try, because it's not worth it. Or, to put this in the positive form, only work with memorable images. Now, just as in literature, where memorable characters like Hamlet or Heathcliff or even Dirty Harry stand out and become symbols for a larger segment of humanity, so in marketing can whole target customer populations become imagined as teeny boppers, yuppies, pickups, and gun racks, or the man in the gray flannel suit. These are all just images, stand-ins for a greater reality, picked out from a much larger set of candidate images on the grounds that they really click with the sum total of an informed person's experience. These were, in short, the memorable ones. Let us call these images characterizations. As such, they represent characteristic market behaviors. Teeny boppers, for example, can be expected to shop at a mall, emulate a rock star, seek peer approval, and resist parental restrictions, all of which imply that certain marketing tactics will be more successful than others in winning over their dollars. Now, visionaries, pragmatists, and conservatives represent a set of images analogous to teeny bopper, yuppie, and so on, albeit at a higher level of abstraction. For each of these labels also represents characteristic market behaviors, specifically in relation to adopting a discontinuous innovation, from which we can predict the success or failure of marketing tactics. The problem is, they are too abstract. They need to become more concrete, more target market specific. That is the function of target customer characterization. Target customer characterization, the use of scenarios. First, please note that we are not focusing here on target market characterization. The place most crossing the chasm marketing segmentation efforts get into trouble is at the beginning, when they focus on a target market or target segment instead of on a target customer. Markets are impersonal, abstract things. The personal computer market, the 1 megabit RAM market, the office automation market, and so on. Neither the names nor the descriptions of markets evoke any memorable images. They do not elicit the cooperation of one's intuitive faculties. We need to work with something that gives more clues about how to proceed. We need something that feels a lot more like real people. However, since we do not have real live customers as yet, we are just going to have to make them up. Then, once we have their images in mind, we can let them guide us to developing a truly responsive approach to their needs. Target customer characterization is a formal process for making up these images, getting them out of individual heads and in front of a marketing decision-making group. The idea is to create as many characterizations as possible, one for each different type of customer and application for the product. It turns out that, as these start to accumulate, they begin to resemble one another, so that somewhere between 20 and 50, you realize you are just repeating the same formulas with minor tweaks, and that in fact, you have outlined 8 to 10 distinct alternatives. Once we have built a basic library of possible target customer profiles, we can then apply technique to reduce these data into a prioritized list of desirable target market segment opportunities. The quotation marks around data are key, of course, because we are still operating in a low data situation. We just have a better set of material to work with. Electronic books, an illustrative example. Footnote. This is the other section of the book that is significantly revised from the original. In the intervening years, the Chasm Group has used the scenario methodology broadly, and what follows reflects a much improved approach. End footnote. For the purposes of illustration, let us consider how we might market an electronic book, where content is downloaded over the internet into a laptop-like device, weighing 3 pounds, dedicated exclusively to reading. The first two of these products, Softbook and Rocket eBook, were launched in the fall of 1998. Their claim to fame is that you can carry as many books as you want with you. Get new books anytime, anywhere, search books with the power of a computer, and, well, be the first kid on your block to own an electronic book. Now, let us suppose that in the first year or so, electronic books win over an early market of technology enthusiasts. Hey, want to see my cool new ebook? And visionaries. With ebooks, we can change the way higher education is conducted. Amazon.com announced it will support downloads. Some way cool book author, say the author formerly known as Tom Clancy, announces his next book will only appear in e-form. The Pentagon buys 10,000 units, but won't say what for. And Tom Cruise puts an e-book in his next movie. Now it is time to go after the mainstream market, taking market share away from traditional paper-based books. Where would you begin? This is a classic case of so many segments, so little time. Exactly the sort of thing that target customer scenarios are best for. A representative format for any given scenario is illustrated in the following section and can be viewed in the enhanced portion of this audiobook. A finished scenario should be limited to a single page. As you will see from the example, this is a highly tactical exercise in microcosm, but it has major implications for how marketing strategy is set overall. So as we work through the example, we will also keep an eye out for the broader implications. Sample scenario. 1. Header information. At the top of the page, you need thumbnail information about the end user, the technical buyer, and the economic buyer of the offer. For business markets, the key data are industry, geography, department, and job title. For consumer markets, they are demographic, age, sex, economic status, social group. For our sample scenario, we are going to focus on a maintenance application in aerospace. So our key header information is user, aerospace, U.S., maintenance department, flight system specialist, technical buyer, IT department, document management applications director, economic buyer, maintenance department, director. In consumer scenarios, the three roles of user, technical buyer, and economic buyer tend to merge into one or two. If the user is a child, the economic buyer is the parent, and the technical buyer is a toss-up. In our house, the child for sure. If the user is an adult, the economic buyer often is the other spouse, as in, is it okay for me to spend our money on this doodad? And the technical buyer tends to be the user. One caveat, though. It is extremely difficult to cross the chasm in consumer markets. Almost all successful crossings happen in business markets, where the economic and technical resources can absorb the challenges of an immature product and service offering. The idea behind the header information is to focus the marketing and R&D teams on a specific instance of how the product would be bought and used. Do not worry about being overly focused at this point. The devil is always in the details, and these scenarios are all about getting the devil in view. 2. A day in the life. Before. The idea here is to describe a situation in which the user is stuck, with significant consequences for the economic buyer. The elements you need to capture are 5. Scene or situation. Focus on the moment of frustration. What is going on? What is the user about to attempt? Desired outcome. What is the user trying to accomplish? Why is this important? Attempted approach. Without the new product, how does the user go about the task? Interfering factors. What goes wrong? How and why does it go wrong? Economic consequences. So what? What is the impact of the user failing to accomplish the task productively? Using aircraft maintenance as an example, we might generate the following. Scene or situation. Ernie has been called in to find out why the Shrivastat light on the aircraft console is blinking red. The plane has boarded and is otherwise ready to depart. As Ernie looks over the dash, he realizes he has never actually worked on a Shrivastat before. Desired outcome. Everyone would like to get the problem diagnosed quickly. Ideally, it would then be fixed and the plane could get on its way. Attempted approach. Ernie calls down to Wally to check out the Shrivastat manual. Unfortunately, the last three revisions have not been posted, so Wally has to go search them down. When he gets them, he tries to describe a diagram over the phone to Ernie, which only confuses things. So Wally gets in a truck to drive over. Interfering factors. Manuals can only be in one place at one time. Paper manuals are challenging to update accurately and in a timely manner. The volume of materials is such that you can't carry them with you. Economic consequences. Flight is canceled. Maintenance crews are taken offline to fix the problem, resulting in overtime and other delays. 3. A day in the life. After. Now the idea is to take the same situation and the same desired outcome, but to replay the scenario with the new technology in place. Here you just need to capture three elements. New approach. With a new product, how does the end user go about the task? Enabling factors. What is it about the new approach that allows the user to get unstuck and be productive? Economic rewards. What are the costs avoided or benefits gained? Staying with the aircraft example, we might generate the following. New approach. Ernie pulls out his ebook, which contains all documentation for the Boeing 737E series, searches for Shrivastat, finds the section, including the diagram and the latest revisions, all automatically downloaded each night. There is a hyperlink in the text to a knowledge base where actual experiences are tracked. Clicking on it, the ebook connects to the base. Ernie spots the problem in a flash, applies the fix, and the plane is on its way. Okay, actually, the plane is still delayed, and I am still on it, but that's another story. Enabling factors. E-books can carry essentially unlimited amounts of material. They can be updated electronically, automatically, over the internet. They can host software tools to support text and topic searches and the like. Economic rewards. Set aside whether the plane flies or not. Cost avoidance lies primarily in maintenance worker productivity. But the system might pay for itself in avoided printing and updating costs. Processing the scenario. The Market Development Strategy Checklist. Target customer characterization is at the core of applying market segmentation strategy to the problem of crossing the chasm. It supplies the data. Assume that we have spent a day with a group of 10 or so field-savvy members of the ebook company, compiling a library of, say, 50 or so of these scenarios. In this library, we have captured scenarios for every current customer, every interesting prospect, whether won, lost, or in waiting, as well as other interesting prospects, which we might know about from past lives. This is not a formal segmentation survey. They take too long, and their output is too dry. Instead, it is a tapping into the fund of anecdotes that actually carries business knowledge in our culture. Like much that is anecdotal, these scenarios will incorporate fictions, falsehoods, prejudices, and the like. Nonetheless, they are by far the most useful and most accurate form of data to work with at this stage in the segmentation process. Compared to SIC codes, for example, they are paragons of accuracy and integrity. Nonetheless, they are still crude at best. And now it is time to submit them to a refinery, the Market Development Strategy Checklist. This list consists of a set of issues around which go-to-market plans are built, each of which incorporates a chasm-crossing factor as follows. Target customer, compelling reason to buy, whole product, partners and allies, distribution, pricing, competition, positioning, next target customer. Processing the scenarios consists of rating each scenario against each of these issues. The process actually takes place in two stages. In stage one, all scenarios are rated against four showstopper issues. Low scores in any one of these typically eliminates the scenario from future consideration as the beachhead segment. That is, the niche may be a good one to pursue after the chasm has been crossed, but it is not a good target for the crossing itself. Scenarios which pass the first cut are rated against the remaining five factors. At both stages, scores are awarded for each factor, and the scenarios are rank ordered by score. At the end of the process, top-ranked scenarios are taken to be the top chasm-crossing targets. They are further discussed until the team commits to one, and only one, beachhead target. The italics immediately above are meant to answer the single most asked question of the chasm group. Can't we go after more than one target? The simple answer is no. The more complex answer is also no, but it takes longer to explain. Just as you cannot hit two balls with one bat swing, hit two birds with one stone, or brush your teeth and your hair at the same time, so you cannot cross the chasm in two places. We've already discussed this, of course, but trust me, one cannot make this point too often. Turning back to the checklist, the four factors that raise showstopper issues for crossing the chasm are as follows. Target customer. Is there a single identifiable economic buyer for this offer, readily accessible to the sales channel we intend to use, and sufficiently well-funded to pay the price for the whole product? In the absence of such a buyer, sales forces waste valuable time evangelizing groups of people trying to generate a sponsor. Sales cycles drag on forever, and the project can be shut down at any time. Compelling reason to buy. Are the economic consequences sufficient to mandate any reasonable economic buyer to fix the problem called out in the scenario? If pragmatists can live with the problem for another year, they will. But they will continue to be interested in learning more. So your salespeople will be invited back again and again. They just won't return with purchase orders. Instead, they will report that the customer said, "Great presentation." What the customer was really saying was, "I learned some more, and I didn't have to buy anything." Whole product. Can our company, with the help of partners and allies, field a complete solution to the target customer's compelling reason to buy in the next 3 months, such that we can be in the market by the end of next quarter and be dominating the market within 12 months thereafter? The clock is ticking. We need to cross now, which means we need a problem we can solve now. Any thread left hanging could be the one that trips us up. Competition. Has this problem already been addressed by another company, such that they have crossed the chasm ahead of us and occupied the space we would be targeting? Dick Hackborn, the HP executive who led the move into laser printers, had a favorite saying, "Never attack a fortified hill." Same with beachheads. If some other company got there before you, all the market dynamics that you are seeking to make work in your favor are already working in its favor. Don't go there. When scenarios are scored against these four factors, 1 to 5, the worst total score they can get is 4. The best, a 20, and with higher rated scenarios preferred. But there is an additional caveat. A very low score, relative to the others, in any of these factors, almost always is a showstopper. So it is not just total score alone that matters. When in doubt, favor scenarios which have a high-rated, compelling reason to buy. If they have already attracted a competitor, see if you can't end-run them. Expect that the best scenarios will be whole product challenged. If it were easy, someone else would have done it. Indeed, the fact that it is hard will create a barrier to entry in your favor once you have stepped up to the solution. The remaining factors fall into the nice-to-have category. That is, low scores can usually be overcome given investment and time. Since, however, investment and time are two of your scarcest resources, cheaper and sooner are very desirable attributes in a target market scenario. Here's how they play out. Partners and allies. Do we already have relationships begun with the other companies needed to fulfill the whole product? If you do, it is typically from a single early market project, or else you are just lucky. Pulling together this partnership is a major challenge for the whole product manager. Distribution. Do we have a sales channel in place that can call on the target customer and fulfill the whole product requirements put on distribution? Calling on the line of business side of the house requires some fluency in the language of the target niche, and established relationships with individuals accelerates this process dramatically. Lacking this, companies typically hire a well-connected individual out of the target industry and charter her to lead the sales force back in. Pricing. Is the price of the whole product consistent with the target customer's budget and with the value gained by fixing the broken process? Do all the partners, including the distribution channel, get compensated sufficiently to keep their attention and loyalty? Note here that it is the whole product price, not the price of the product per se, that matters. Services will often take as much or more of this total as product. Positioning. Is the company credible as a provider of products and services to the target niche? At the outset, the answer is typically not very. One of the delights of niche marketing, however, is the speed at which this resistance can be overcome if only one truly commits to a whole product that fixes the broken process. Next target customer. If we are successful in dominating this niche, does it have good bowling pin potential? That is, will these customers and partners facilitate our entry into adjacent niches? This is an important issue of strategy. Chasm crossing is not the end, but rather the beginning of mainstream market development. It is important that we have additional follow-on niches that can be lucratively addressed. Else the economics of niche marketing simply do not hold up. After the scenarios that pass the first round of showstopper screening have been scored on this second set of factors, and then rank ordered by score, the team has extracted all of the data this process can provide. It is now time to make the high-risk, low-data decision and get on with it. Committing to the point of attack. Making the commitments to a niche market can be challenging, especially for entrepreneurs who are technology enthusiasts or visionaries, because they personally don't have the pragmatist response and thus have trouble trusting in the market dynamics outlined in this book. This is a defining moment for them. The startup company must either cross or die. But what value is life if, to gain it, one has to go against one's best self? Not an easy question to answer. When faced with such nasty decisions, it is usually best to make them quickly, get into the new flow, and plan to course correct going forward. This is a whitewater rafting strategy, where hesitating on a split decision is the one behavior guaranteed to capsize the boat. When you do pick, you pick hard. That is, you go hard in the direction chosen, regardless of doubts. Just so with crossing the chasm. The good news in this is that you do not have to pick the optimal beachhead to be successful. What you must do is win the beachhead you have picked. If there is a genuine problem in the segment, you will have the target customer pulling for you. If it is a hard problem and the segment is reasonably small, you probably will not have the competition to distract you. This means you can focus all your attention on the whole product, which is where it needs to be. Nail that, and you win. What could cause you to change course? Most often, it is that the scenario that is driving the effort is based on a false assumption. To guard against this, you should commission some market research early in the process, specifically to validate the winning scenario. But you should not wait for this research to be complete before you start forward. The enemy in the chasm is always time. You must force the pace at all times, even when in doubt, because standing still plays into the hands of the established vendors and the status quo. And yes, size matters. Finally, when you are on the verge of making the commitment to the target segment, sooner or later, the issue of how much revenue the segment could generate comes up. At this point, people normally think that bigger is better. In fact, this is almost never the case. Here's why. To become a going concern, a persistent entity in the market, you need a customer market that will commit to you as its de facto standard for enabling a critical business process. To become that de facto standard, you need to win at least half, and preferably a lot more, of the new orders in the segment over the next year. That is the sort of vendor performance that causes pragmatist customers to sit up and take notice. At the same time, you will still be taking orders from other segments. So do the math. Suppose you can get half of next year's orders from the target segment. No mean feat, considering that, prior to a couple of days ago, you hadn't focused on it at all. Say your revenue target is $10 million overall. That means $5 million from the target segment. It also means that same $5 million has to represent at least half of the total orders from the segment if you are to have the desired market leader impact. In other words, if you are going to be a $10 million company next year, you do not want to attack a segment larger than $10 million. At the same time, it should be large enough to generate your $5 million. So the rule of thumb in crossing the chasm is simple. Pick on somebody your own size. If you find the target segment is too big, sub-segment it. But be careful here. You must respect word-of-mouth boundaries. The goal is to become a big fish in a small pond, not one flopping about trying to straddle a couple of mud puddles. The best sub-segmentation is based on special interest groups within the general community. These typically are very tightly networked and normally form because they have very special problems to solve. In the absence of such, geography can often be a safe sub-segmentation variable, provided that it affects the way communities congregate. If the target segment is too small to generate half of next year's sales for the new product, then you have to augment it. Again, be careful to respect genuine segmentation boundaries. If there is no appropriate super segment, then you probably should go back and pick another target. Recap. The target market selection process. We have been saying all along that the material in this chapter and the following three chapters is tactical by nature. That is, made up of relatively specific tasks and exercises that can and should be performed recurrently throughout a major enterprise. As a way of recapping this material, at the end of each chapter, there will be a checklist of activities suitable as a means either for managing a group through this process or testing the final output of a group's marketing decision-making. For selecting the target market segment that will serve as the point of entry for crossing the chasm into the mainstream market, the checklist is as follows. 1. Develop a library of target customer scenarios. Draw from anyone in the company who would like to submit scenarios, but go out of your way to elicit input from people in customer-facing jobs. Keep adding to it until new additions are no more than minor variations on existing scenarios. 2. Appoint a subcommittee to make the target market selection. Keep it as small as possible, but include on it anyone who could veto the outcome. 3. Number and publish the scenarios in typed form, one page per scenario. Accompanying the bundle, provide a spreadsheet with the rating factors assigned to columns and the scenarios assigned to rows. Break the rating factors into two subtotals, showstoppers first, then nice-to-haves. 4. Have each member of the subcommittee privately rate each scenario on the showstopper factors. Roll up individual ratings into a group rating. During this process, discuss any major disagreements about scores. This typically surfaces different points of view on the same scenario, and is critical not just to getting the opportunity correctly in focus, but also in laying the groundwork for a future consensus that will stick. 5. Rank order the results and set aside scenarios which do not pass the first cut. This is typically about 2/3 of the submissions. 6. In a 400-degree oven, bake. Oops, wrong book. Sorry. Repeat the private rating and public ranking process on the remaining scenarios with the remaining selection factors. Winnow the scenario population down to, at most, a favored few. 7. Depending on outcome, proceed as follows. Group agrees on beachhead segment. Go forward on that basis. Group cannot decide among a final few. Give the assignment to one person to build a bowling pin model of market development, incorporating as many of the final few as is reasonable, and calling out a head pin. Attack the head pin. No scenario survived. This does happen. In that case, do not attempt to cross the chasm. Also, do not try to grow. Continue to take early market projects, keep burn rate as low as possible, and continue search for a viable beachhead. 5. Assemble the invasion force. I have always found you get a lot more in this world with a kind word and a gun than you do with just a kind word. Willie Sutton. Willie is only restating what any military leader will confirm. If you are committing an act of aggression, you'd better have the force to back it up. Or, to put this in terms closer to our immediate topic, marketing is warfare, not wordfare. Which of us, about to launch an invasion, would prefer a good set of slogans to a good set of offensive and defensive weapons? Who would rather buy advertising time on television than missiles and munitions? Who would rather publish a manifesto than have guaranteed treaties with neighboring countries? Most high-tech executives, that's who. There is a widespread perception among high-tech executives that marketing consists primarily of some long-range strategic thinking, when you can afford to take the time for it, and then a lot of tactical sales support, with nothing in between. In fact, marketing's most powerful contribution happens right in between. It is called whole product marketing, a term introduced earlier, and it is the fundamental basis for assembling the invasion force. Consider the following scenario. When I was a salesman, I had a dream. The dream was simple. There was a monster bid coming up with a $5 million minimum, and I had wired the request for proposal, RFP. I had, in the words of gamblers everywhere, a mortal lock on the thing. The client had met with me for long hours of consultation, during which he had bought into every selling argument in favor of my product. He had then constructed the RFP so that only my product could get a 100% evaluation. The deal was mine. Then I woke up. Okay, so that's a fantasy. But a version of that fantasy can be executed in the real world. We might call it wiring the marketplace. Again, the concept is simple. For a given target customer and a given application, create a marketplace in which your product is the only reasonable buying proposition. That starts, as we saw in the last chapter, with targeting markets that have a compelling reason to buy your product. The next step is to ensure that you have a monopoly over fulfilling that reason to buy. To secure that monopoly, you need to understand, one, what a whole product consists of, and two, how to organize a marketplace to provide a whole product incorporating your company's offering. The whole product concept. One of the most useful marketing constructs to become integrated into high-tech marketing in the past few years is the concept of a whole product, an idea described in detail in Theodore Levitt's The Marketing Imagination, and one that plays a significant role in Bill Davidow's Marketing High Technology. The concept is very straightforward. There is a gap between the marketing promise made to the customer, the compelling value proposition, and the ability of the shipped product to fulfill that promise. For that gap to be overcome, the product must be augmented by a variety of services and ancillary products to become the whole product. The formal model figure, as you can see by the figure on the enhanced portion of this audiobook, is diagrammed by Levitt as follows. The model identifies four different perceptions of product as follows. 1. Generic product. This is what is shipped in the box and what is covered by the purchasing contract. 2. Expected product. This is the product that the consumer thought she was buying when she bought the generic product. It is the minimum configuration of products and services necessary to have any chance of achieving the buying objective. For example, people who are buying personal computers for the first time expect to get a monitor with their purchase. How else could you use the computer? But in fact, in most cases, it is not part of the generic product. 3. Augmented product. This is the product fleshed out to provide the maximum chance of achieving the buying objective. In the case of a personal computer, this would include a variety of products, such as software, a hard disk drive, and a printer, as well as a variety of services, such as a customer hotline, advanced training, and readily accessible service centers. 4. Potential product. This represents the product's room for growth as more and more ancillary products come on the market and as customer-specific enhancements to the system are made.